What is your thought on that suggestion, this belief, this notion that somehow all of these terroristic acts that are committed against black people, that somehow this is the result of white people being ignorant about some aspect of racism or lacking awareness, knowledge of racism?
Yeah, you know, I think, as you know, I have a huge problem with this issue, with this concept, right? I find it untenable, and I find it apologetic to endow white people with virtue and almost a childlike innocence when they have to deal with something like white supremacy and racism. The argument seems to proceed on the fact that even when white people do seemingly deliberate acts against racialized peoples, racialized folk, that even those acts where they directly benefit from it are done out of ignorance. And I think that what this sustains is this kind of cherub nature, this nature that white people are really aiming and willing to learn and to correct their behavior if just this right black person came along and taught them what to do. I find that just ridiculous, right? I mean, we have to look at the historical context. We know that white people have done the same types of behaviors. They've discriminated against black people. They've called black people niggers. They've called black people God knows what other names. They've always vitiated blackness. They've secluded and segregated blackness. To repeat those things doesn't seem to be the work of ignorance. In fact, it seems to be the repetition of historical knowledge about how to treat black folk. So when we see the same thing, ignorance seems to be just an unrealistic apologetic. The other problem I have with this is, as you say, this makes its way into the academy. I mean, the dominant way that we do race and racism today in the university is to endow white people with this type of ignorance. And actually, the work that I'm doing right now on anti-ethics specifically responds to this issue, right? That every time we think that we're talking about race or racism, what we do is we elevate white people's morality and their type of character so that they become these very neutral and observer speakers where they can be influenced and allegedly objectively arbitrate racial realities before them. This is all false. I mean, even the work that's done in implicit bias shows that white people have some very deep-seated cultural and unconscious anti-black biases in their interactions and in terms of their social reality when looking at engaging black folk. So to suggest that white people are simply innocent, right? Because ignorance does in many ways connote innocence. To suggest they're innocent simply because they do not know or hence ignorant doesn't really capture the cultural and the psychological works of how racism against black people function. And what this does is this elevates certain black speakers. And this is the really important part. To suggest that white people are simply ignorant and need to be taught elevate certain black speakers to the position of the teacher. And this, we spoke about this before when I talked about critical race therapies, right? When the black people say, oh, they're ignorant and take on the charge of educating these white people who have committed racist acts instead of ostracizing them or attacking them, they now become that preferred Negro. They become the person that's rewarded with the publications, with the invitations, because they're just trying to teach white folk. The black person that holds those white people accountable for their racist acts and for the effect that those acts have had on other black people, well, that person becomes the radical. So white ignorance is a kind of dialogue and rhetoric that's gained hold precisely because it maintains white virtue. It allows us to see white people as being the good, innocent, intellectual, rational person that can learn to change, whereas black people are the collateral damage of such engagements. Because as that white person changes, black people are still being discriminated against, and they're actually the material, the substance of the lesson. I just find that to be an unacceptable consequence for such empty rhetoric.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, October 13, 2021. So I have been told our book club will be tomorrow. We got so many plugs for our book club when we had our guest Guy Lancaster on the broadcast Monday. Tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I am giddy. Shaft, one of the best picks ever for the book club. Ernest Tidyman, you can still be conducting your counter-racist experiment. Go out and ask if you have black parents, black grandparents, aunts, uncles, any black people in your family. They've seen Shaft. Ask them, hey, that Shaft movie, Richard Roundtree and all, or any version of it, really. Did you know that was based on a book written by a white man? And see what they say. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, the book club tomorrow, Shaft. Anywho, our broadcast for today, we heard Dr. Tommy J. Curry at the beginning of the broadcast, one of his earlier visits to the program. He's visited us numerous times, and we heard a lot of that Monday from Guy Lancaster, a white man, that white people are ignorant or unaware or not informed about some aspect of racism, white supremacy, and I am borrowing a page from our president, George W. Bush, 2 terms. You got to be preemptive sometimes about the, what would I say, the great deception that white people are not informed or not aware or not conscious of white supremacy, racism. That is not possible. I can only conclude, since so many people, including Guy Lancaster, who was with us on Monday, insisting that, oh yes, there are many different ways that white people are just not aware or ignorant or willed ignorance. They have lots of different phraseology, but at the end of the day, Gus T is submitting all of that is a lie. Just get that out in front and move forward from there. Our broadcast for today, I was in lovely Seattle, best plantation in the U.S. I was here and walking at Green Lake, which I've done the whole spring, summer, lots this year. Walking through Green Lake, they had a flyer up, and it's posted with the broadcast, so you can check it out. But the flyer, so curious, it was for this Zoom reading group. And I'll read a little bit. It says, "Whiteness is not an ancestor, book study and reflection group." I say, wow, I read a little bit. How do we reckon with a family history of racism? Join local writer June Bluespruce to delve into the book Whiteness is Not an Ancestor, Essays on Life and Lineage by White Women. Using a lens of inherited trauma and family history, the collection of 12 personal essays offers a brave, humanizing path to dismantle whiteness. And it goes on to add a little bit more. There were 2 Zoom sessions. I said, wow, that is fascinating. Like, what's reading more important than watching television? But wow, right here in Green Lake, I can't believe it. So I take a picture and look online. I find the book, say, hey, it'd be awesome. Let's see if we can get the writer to come on the program. Now, as you heard, this is a collection of 12 different essays by different white women. So she says, hey, we might even be able to get the editor of the book who helped put all this together. She has a selection, the foreword. I guess that's another essay if you want to count it. In the book, she might even be able to come and join us. Wow, even better. We'll have more the merrier. I even looked on the switchboard, and I think we have one of the other ladies who wrote one of the essays for the, I guess, book collection of essays that we'll be discussing for this evening. Always excited to have white people as guests on the program. As I was reading through the book, I saw some familiar names. Same thing that I said on Monday. So depending on how long you've been a listener to the Cows, Katrina Brown, guest on the program all the way back 2010, one of the worst documentaries I've ever seen. And I told her this on the program, so this is not me, you know, gossiping or anything. In the archives, Dr. Joy DeGruy Leary, guest on the program repeatedly. And in fact, I hung out with Dr. DeGruy at the White Privilege Conference in Wisconsin, which I took the train to get to. We were just talking about taking the train. And even Paul Kibble, guest on the program way back 2010. Matter of fact, all of these folks were guests on the program in 2010. Dr. Joy DeGruy Leary has been on repeatedly, but 2000, I don't know if that was a good year, but they all were with us in 2010. Anywho, for our program today, it will be a hoot to have some of the authors of the collection of essays, Whiteness is Not an Ancestor. Always great to speak with white people who want to address this problem. Encourage listeners to dial in with questions. Let's see. We should have one of the authors who I spoke with via phone. In fact, so much had happened, I forgot, like, oh, yeah, we talked on the phone. And once I started reading the essay, it all came back to me. So her name was mentioned in the flyer, the person that I reached out to begin with, Miss June Blue Spruce. Miss Blue Spruce, you're with us?
Yes. Hi, Gus.
Greetings, Miss Blue Spruce. And then we also have, she wrote the foreword and helped put this project together, Miss Lisa Iverson. You're with us as well?
Yeah. Hello, this is Lisa. Good to be with you.
Awesome. Awesome. So good to have both of you with us. Thanks for sharing a bit of your Wednesday evening. We're going to try to cover as much as we can. Looks like listeners are already tuned in, so they might have a good number of questions. So to try to cover as much as we can, it'd be great. You can give us as much detail as you like with answering the questions, but try not to get too lengthy with responses and make sure that you do answer questions. I've noted many times white people do not answer questions directly or at all when talking about racism, white supremacy, especially with non-white people. So is that something I can ask of both of you, Ms. Iverson, Ms. Blue Spruce?
Absolutely. Yes.
Much obliged. Let's see. To start out, I guess if we could get both of you to give a little bit of background just about who you are, the work that you do, we'll start Miss Blue Spruce.
Hi there. I worked for many years in healthcare. Essay that I wrote really focuses on healthcare. I'm retired from that work. I still facilitate different kinds of groups. And I do some activist work in my community, and I write. So that gives you a little background about me.
We'll get into some of the details when we get to her report and ask questions and all that good
sure.
stuff. Same to Ms. Iverson, just who you are, the work that you do.
Yeah, thanks for asking. I've been a social worker, psychotherapist for 30 years. 20 out of those 30, I've been doing a lot of groups, working with generational history, historic trauma, particularly the role of colonialism, slavery, and immigration in family histories, and the relationship between individual family and larger collective landscapes of history. So, and so I work with people, groups, and also write.
Awesome. Awesome. We'll also go over the foreword that you wrote for the book and other questions. Get your views on racism. Listeners can dial in as well with their questions. You are both, it would seem obvious from the title and everything, but we ask all of our folks, folks who haven't seen you or not paying attention, you are both classified as white women. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Said it in stereo. Wowee. Awesome. Okay. I have to make one more request. And for listeners who pay attention or have been listening to the cows really at all, you could have been listening for the past 4 days and you'd have heard this. Words are very important when discussing racism, white supremacy, and for the cows specifically, I've talked about metaphors for more than a decade now. If you all, to the best of your ability, could refrain from metaphors when giving answers or expressing your views, I've just found that a lot of times metaphors will be used when discussing racism, and that just doesn't provide enough precision, enough clarity. Sometimes people aren't familiar with the metaphors or things that are being compared, so that's something Cal's listeners can testify. I talk about this all the time, and in fact, we have one program every week where no metaphors from anyone. So if that is one request that I can make, no metaphors, let's be precise about what we're saying. Is that acceptable?
It's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
That's fine.
Much obliged.
I appreciate clarity.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
and directness. Yep.
Amen.
Yep.
Amen. Amen. Especially when talking about white supremacy, racism. Okey-doke.
Yep.
We start all of our programs with the definition. I'll say for listeners, too, it is a little odd because we normally only have one person on the program. So having multiple folks is always extra work for Gus T. That's happened a few times this year. for our definition. Definitions, very important words, definitions, critically important for clarity. The two terms, racism and white supremacy, I use them as synonyms and the same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate? Let's see, we'll go with Miss Iverson first.
Yeah, that resonates. That resonates is truth. Yeah. I'm glad to say a little bit more what comes to mind, but I don't want to, take up time to do so. But bottom line is, yeah, I think that's true.
We'll certainly have time for details. And certainly anything that you don't agree with, don't feel like, you have to agree with anything, all about, just being truthful about responses, what your views are.
Yes.
Miss Blue Spruce, do you think that definition that I just gave is accurate? And do you think such a system exists?
Yes to both.
Oh, wow. That doesn't happen very often where people are that concise in the response to the definition. Okay. Let's see. I'm stealing a question one of our investors would normally ask, but I'm just important to ask this one early on. We asked Mr. Lancaster this question when he was with us on Monday. In terms of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, which group of people do you think is more confused? Do you think that white people are more confused about what racism is, how it works, or do you think non-white people are more confused about what racism is, how it works? Let's see. We'll go... Miss June Blue Spruce, your thoughts?
I know that white people are confused about that to different degrees. I think there are some white people who know very well exactly how it works, and I think they benefit from keeping other white people confused. That stymies movement for change. It seems to me that non-white people know a lot about how racism works, but I can't speak for non-white people.
I just want to make sure I got a clear answer to the question. So which group do you think is more confused about what racism is and how it works? Do you think white people in general are more confused about that, or do you think non-white people are more confused?
That's really, I don't know. I tend to think that, I tend to think that white people are more confused about it.
Clean answer. Much obliged. Same question to you. This is Lisa Iverson. Which group do you think is more confused about what racism is, how it works? Individuals classified as white or people classified as not white?
Yeah, thanks for the question. My answer is, I don't think there's any confusion about how it works for anybody. That that the question, this answer may not be pleasing, but that's, none of us is here to be pleasing. So, we're, if in the spirit of telling the truth, what comes to me is that, the question itself is actually aligned with keeping it going. So for me, in the spirit of stopping it, I would say two things. One, I don't think there's any confusion about how it works. And number two, the question is aligned with racism itself. And I'm more interested in stopping it than keeping it going.
So just making sure I grasp your response, you said that you don't think there's any confusion about what racism, mm-hmm. white supremacy is, how it works. So you don't think white people or non-white people are confused about the system that's in operation here?
I don't think there's any confusion about it. No.
Okay.
That might be a controversial thing to say, but no, I don't think there's any confusion about it.
Just a view. Just a view. Process, try to use logic, evaluate what we hear, see if it makes sense, and maybe get more details along the way. Okay, so we got those two answered. One more, and then we'll get to some more detail, get to the book, get to the questions. This is one we've been asking our white guests for some time. There was a non-white author, and he wrote a report in a mainstream publication. He was talking about racism. He had one specific sentence. He wrote, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And I've been asking white people the first component of that sentence. White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. Just you as a white woman, the white people that you've been around, family, co-workers, studies that you've done in racism and what have you, do you think that a substantial number of individuals classified as white are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
This is Lisa. I just wanted to check if you had a preference, if I answered first or.
Oh, I forgot I had to specify. We got multiple guests. Yes, ma'am. We'll go with Ms. Iverson first. Yes, ma'am. Sorry about that.
I guess I would say that I do have a question. It's a clarifying question. Whether numbness is considered to be in the question, is numbness considered to be pain? So that's for me a clarifying question that to help give an answer that,
no,
are you suggesting numbness is no. Yeah, I think a lot of white people, I can't speak on behalf of all white people.
I want to stop right there because that's a common one. I didn't ask you to speak on behalf of all white people. I haven't asked anyone to do that ever on the program. This is just your view, and I think I was very specific. You as someone who's written a book about racism, you study this, you read books about racism, facilitate conversation about this. You can speak to your studies. The question was just simply, do you think a significant population of white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? That would be, this might even be an example, because we've heard that so often that I can't speak for all white people. No one has ever been asked to do so on this platform. That might be one where I point out where the obfuscating and not answering the question. But again, Ms. Iverson, your response to the question was?
No. I mean, my answer is, I think a lot of people are not pained by racism. a lot of white people are not pained by racism.
Okay. So we got to know. June Blue Spruce, same question. Do you think a substantial or significant population of individuals classified as white are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
I would agree and say no.
Okay.
I think if the answer was yes, things would be different.
Logic, that's one that I think about frequently, just using logic sometimes to make evaluations. And even what she said, now I think about what Ms. Iverson's response was at first. Just using logic, like some things in my view are self-evident about racism, white supremacy, which, yeah, some things are kind of self-evident about racism, white supremacy. Let's see. So I got most of the questions that are specific. Now we can get, I had a few detailed questions for you all, specifically about the subject matter, what I saw in the flyer, like my goodness. And then specifics about the book, and we'll get to callers. The number of people want to dial in, you have a question for Ms. Lisa Iverson, Ms. June Blue Spruce, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Please don't wait till the last minute. Had lots of that on Monday. Not cool. So I looked at the flyer that was posted here in Crean Lake, and I read a little bit for our listeners, and I thought, wow, I'd have to ask this one early on since we'll have two white women, and even some of the other co-authors will get them in as well. I'm just starting with you all since I wrote you all first, Ms. Blue Spruce specifically. So I looked at the flyer, I'm like, wow, they're getting into details about the role of white women in all of this, which I think is super important. So many times these conversations make racism, white supremacy exclusively the business of white men, which is, again, just following logic. That can't be the case. So for the both of you, what or how were you taught to function as white women in a system of white supremacy? And this is one where, like, details are important because I think there are a lot of different components to this. But let's go, Ms. Blue Spruce. How were you taught to function as a white woman in a system of white supremacy?
Boy, that is a big question. I'll do my best. I was taught to be afraid, to feel vulnerable, which I think is common. I was taught to do good, you know, to kind of in general try to be someone who took care of people and, you know, tried to make things better for people. And I think that leads to a kind of condescension and a type of expression of racism that can be really harmful. Let me see if I can think of anything else. I was taught that whatever I had, you know, possessions, position, had to do with merit. Of course, as a woman, you know, you have a different challenge in terms of merit than men do, but than white men do, to be specific. But that there's this, you know, idea that whatever one has in the world comes from one's work, which is clearly not true. Let me see. I think that's, I'll stop there and then maybe add more later.
I just want to clarify. So the question, H-O-W, how were you taught to function?
Oh, how? Okay, okay.
So, yes.
Thank you.
And specifically,
yeah,
how
thank
were you taught
your...
to function in relation to individuals classified as Black? That's kind of an important one, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me clarify the how. You mean, how were these beliefs imparted to me, or what
yes.
specifically was I instructed to do?
All of the above.
Because those are two ways.
How you ended up arriving.
Yeah,
at
you know, that is a really good question, because most of it was not explicit to me or obvious to me. I think it comes through, well, you know, things my mother would say to me about racial situations in the town I grew up in. Things my dad would say to me. I mentioned something about that in the essay. So definitely from my parents. Some from my peers, certainly. Media, television, books. I think I was taught to be good and to be careful. I don't know. I'm trying to think of how to be specific about that. Well-behaved, not to talk about difficult things.
While you're thinking, do you recall any racist jokes? You said comments from your peers and things that some of your white family members were saying. Do you recall any racist jokes? And if so, can you share?
I don't remember racist jokes. I remember a situation in which I said something racist. I was in elementary school. And I said I was in the bathroom, in a bathroom stall next to another white girl. And I said something racist about one of the very few Black girls in my class. And
say?
I exited the stall. I made a comment about how she smelled. And it was something I had learned from other people, obviously. I exited the bathroom stall and her mother was standing there. Her mother worked for the school. And you can imagine what she said to me. And I felt such shame. And I think that encounter, I am, you know, horrified that I said that and that I caused pain to that mother. Being a mother myself, I can imagine, you know, how that must have felt. But I think that being called on that at such a young age really made an impact on me. You know, there was a situation in my hometown where a Black, so I grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia that was mostly white, that was, the housing was strictly segregated. So there was one neighborhood that was the Black neighborhood and, you know, and it was redlined, like, you know, many areas of the U.S. at that time. This is back in the 50s. And there was a family that wanted to move outside the redlined area and wanted to integrate the segregated swim club. This is in the, you know, mid-Atlantic. This is not in the South. And, you know, my mother was offended by this, and she told me about it. So, you know, those are some of the kinds of influences, specific influences that I had.
Much obliged for the detail. Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Brotherly love indeed.
Exactly. Yeah.
Miss Iverson, same question to you. How were you taught, instructed to function as a white woman in a system of white supremacy? And if you could please include how you were taught to function in relation to individuals classified as black.
Yeah, thank you for the question. The how has so much to do with what's not talked about. So I grew up in a rural area, farming region, where there, when I was growing up, it was a sea of white families. One black family moved to the town where I grew up in my late grade school years. And I remember the feeling strongly, and without words, I remember the communication, the field of communication, because all fields have this, all fields have messages that are given without words, that the difference, this family was somehow not to be considered the same in the same way as the white families. And as a white woman, I would say the message that I, in hindsight, the message that I received was that white women don't have any sense, don't have a role. As a white woman, what was communicated to me in the field, in the communication field, in the energy field, call it whatever kind of field you like, but without words, there was a sense that as a white woman, I didn't have a role with racism. I also grew up, it was in the north, it was actually in Minnesota, and so the message was also that racism is not in the north, it's just the problem of the south, and so that's beyond, that was just a message that went hand in hand with these other things that were communicated without words. And those, feel free to, if I didn't answer fully, feel free to ask me follow-up questions. But those are the things that come to mind to say, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, one more thing. Mm-hmm. In the field, what was communicated just inherent in the context was that white people get land. White people have land. It was just inherent in the context. Because of what was. That was the field around me. Yeah.
That almost sounds like a metaphor, the field around you. That does seem like a metaphor. I did prompt about that before. And sea of white families, that also is a metaphor. There was a reason Gus said that at the beginning, even though now I do say, hey, unpack those metaphors. People drown in the ocean, a sea of white families and one black person. Like, yeah, some of those metaphors do reveal a lot about white supremacy, racism. But yes, if we could make an effort to be precise, because even in your response, like that white people get land and that there's no place for you in racism or there's no place for you in communications, like that's not really a how are you taught to function as a white woman, and specifically to how am I taught to function in relation to black people as a white woman? Like there are not other specific examples that you can think of in terms of how information was relayed to you about what you are supposed to do and not supposed to do as someone classified as a white woman?
Well, I my answers are actually not metaphors. I understand that they might sound like they are, but I'm saying them as facts of this is where I grew up, and this is what I understood that you were hoping to hear by way of answer was, you know, the facts. So those are the facts. Yeah, I'm not going to make stuff up because you don't like what I said. Sorry. if you didn't like my answer, I'm sorry.
I didn't ask for an apology, and it's certainly not about not liking the answer. This might be another one. In fact, this is two, and this is with Mrs. Iverson as well, obfuscating in the responses. Like, it's not that difficult. You admitted to being classified as a white woman. I'm sure you were not born understanding that you are a white woman and what that means. So you had to get some sort of knowledge that had to be imparted to you in some way. I'm just pointing out that you didn't answer the question, which I said at the beginning is very common when talking to white people. You have to be specific about the question, make sure that they answer your question. And I submit that is one of the ways they consistently practice racism, white supremacy. You have to be very mindful about that. Never about liking a response or disliking a response. Just trying to make sure my question gets answered and we evaluate for logic. Moving forward, thank you both. Context of White Supremacy, our guests, Lisa Iverson, June Blue Spruce. Make sure that I ask the both of you, since we all agree system of white supremacy, racism exists, is it logical for me, a non-white person, or for any individual classified as non-white, to be suspicious of any person who is classified as white, including the two of you? Is that logical in a system of white supremacy, Ms. Blue Spruce?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Ms. Iverson, same question. Is that logical?
Absolutely. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Gotcha. Much obliged. Let's see. Next question. I see some of the folks with hands up, so I'll get a few more questions and then we'll get to some of our callers. Let's see. I guess this might be a question for Miss Blue Spruce specifically, because your name was the only one that I saw on the flyer for the reading group. I guess, how did you decide to post, you know, the location? Because the one that I saw was in Green Lake. So were these flyers like dispersed throughout Seattle, or did you pick a specific neighborhood? And if so, what was the thought process?
So I was working with Gathering Ground, which is an organization that does kind of an eclectic kind of spiritual work here in Seattle. And one of the people associated with Gathering Ground printed the flyers and gave me a pile of them, and she took a pile of them, and we just chatted about where to put them up. I have taught a lot of different kinds of workshops, so I have a long list of places to post flyers all over the city I live in Southeast Seattle, in Columbia City. So I posted them here and in the Mount Baker area in Columbia City and some down in further in the South End, Renton, you know, and she posted them in the North End. So we just kind of split up the city and did what we could each do, which it was interesting because in the pandemic, you know, a lot of the places I used to post things are closed. So we just did the best we could to get the word out as broadly as we could.
Fascinating.
So
okay.
she posted the one in Green Lake. I didn't post that one.
Okay. Okay. So I could have seen this flyer dispersed in other parts of the city, South Seattle and all the red. Just happened to be that I saw the one in Green Lake. Okay. Okay.
Hopefully. That was our intention, you know, how well we did, you know, we did the best we could.
Okay. Okay. Context of white supremacy, reading, and I posted the flyer so folks can check it out. You can read, you know, the whole spiel about what the two sessions were supposed to be about, Zoom sessions. For they had one in September, mm-hmm. and then they had one this past weekend, second weekend in October. But again, it's, so it's based on the book title, where they have the book title at the top, Whiteness is Not an Ancestor, Book Study and Reflection. And then they go into some of the detail about what all this is going to entail in the session, I guess. And then if you read the book, whiteness is explained at the very beginning as opposed to white as a racial classification. So I guess I'll give both of you a chance if you want to share some commentary on why the use of the term whiteness and any clarification that you want to provide about what you mean when you use the term whiteness. We'll go with Lisa Iverson first on this one.
Yeah, thank you. Whiteness, as for the book, we included, we began with the context of the definition of whiteness as this idea that began, you know, 500 plus years ago as a way to promote dehumanization practices that is most evident by the categorization, using whiteness as a way to categorize people as white people or black people or other races, you know, the creation of race as a way to promote division and fundamentally to justify dehumanization. So that's what the definition is about. And so the collection of essays was a way for white women to address how whiteness has functioned or does function in their lives, in their family histories, generational histories, as a way to promote greater visibility of this history, and ultimately to promote movements of truth and not only reconciliation, but I would say also reparation. So that's what I would say. I don't know, June, if there's anything else you want to say.
No, I would agree with what you just said. I was listening to a podcast about this, and just that, you know, early on, white indentured servants and black indentured servants were starting to work together to try to improve their lot. And once the legislators and slave owners and other powers that be really latched onto the idea of whiteness, then it successfully divided people from each other who otherwise had interests in common. And, we see the impact of that to this day in really powerful ways.
Okay. Just for listeners, we have talked about Bacon's Rebellion on the broadcast before. If folks recall, Jacqueline Battalora, a white woman, she's been on the cast, been on the cows more than once. And her work, she talks about how those, if you want to say dividing people, divisions, the practice of white supremacy racism, there was evidence that this was happening before Bacon's Rebellion, one that she points to in law. Black people were not allowed to have firearms in the Commonwealth, a very clear separation, distinction made well before Bacon's Rebellion. That's one piece that she talks about in her work, that you can see lots of evidence that this was already in effect and just gaining momentum. A question, I guess, for both of you, is it possible for someone, including yourselves, two white women that we have here, is it possible for a person to be classified, accepted as white, and totally disconnected from the concept that you call whiteness? I'll start, I guess, with Miss Blue Spruce. Did it again. Miss Blue Spruce, both of you get a chance at this one.
So the classification of white, so I think it's possible, not right now, but eventually. I mean, we've got a long way to go before we get there. Someone who has genetically pale skin and other genetic characteristics that are commonly associated with whiteness, and the category of white is a very slippery category that keeps expanding and contracting depending on, where different groups are at. I think it is possible for so someone classified as white in this value system is part of whiteness. But I think it is possible for someone who has Northern European heritage and has some of those genetic characteristics to disconnect themselves from whiteness. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done for that to happen. If that makes sense.
Have you been able to do that? Disconnect yourself?
No.
Do you know?
Not yet. Working on it.
Do you know any individual classified as white who has been able to disconnect themselves?
No, okay. Not yet.
In your
you asked if it was possible.
Right, but in your response, you said, we've had the laughter. I'm just pointing this out for non-white listeners. There's been some laughter at key points here where I didn't really find anything funny, but we've talked about that before as well. Within your response, you said it's possible, but not right now. And then you add a lot of other things. This is one that's real important. Like, if it's not possible right now and you don't know anybody who's done it right now, no. Like, because
okay.
I feel like that's when we end up drifting off into a lot of confusion. Just using logic, listeners, using logic. Same question to Miss Iverson. I guess I have to be specific. So presently, is it possible for someone to be classified as white and disconnected from the concept that you call whiteness? Miss Iverson?
No. No.
Oh, okay. Okay. My conclusion in this one for our listeners, Dr. Frances Cresswell's and grandsister, one of her very first visits on the cows, we talked about the concept whiteness, and she recommended that we not use this term. I've concluded that there are many different ways that everybody avoids identifying what's on the logo for this broadcast and has been for over a decade. The problem is white people. That is very different than saying whiteness. In fact, I'd say whiteness is a metaphor. There are lots of ways that people avoid the problem and what is happening. Individuals who classify themselves as white, all of the things that you tie to the concept of whiteness, they engage in thought, speech, and behaviors that promote the system of white supremacy, racism in all areas of people activity. And just not being simple with that in mind. Now, we do have some folks with us. Miss Iverson, she said that there's no confusion about what's happening here. That's not my opinion. I'm of the opinion that there's a lot of confusion, particularly among non-white people. But, you know, we'll think about that as we proceed. But whiteness, in my view, is not the most accurate term to describe what's happening. I've concluded a lot of times people will come up with terms that are obfuscating and deliberately ambiguous, vague, less than accurate in order to promote confusion. But we've talked about this concept, whiteness, before on the program. I'll pause here. I had sections. I have to read the portion about Miss Blue Spruce, her grandfather, Temple University. We have med students in the Cows audience who I was stunned reading the passage. We just talked about all this with the American Medical Association, like stunning. Let's see if I can nab a caller or two, and then we can get to the book. Whiteness is not an ancestor. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Much obliged to the folks who did not wait till the last minute to dial in. Our caller, Cherry in Atlanta, if you have a question. Oh, wait a minute. Don't see her on there. Switch that around. Not Cherry in Atlanta. Our caller, Mo in Dallas, if you have a question for Lisa Iverson, June Blue Spruce, line should be open. Let's see. Oh, me once. There we go. Give me a second to find you on the switchboard, sir. Mo in Dallas should be with us.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Thank you for the program, sir. I do only have one question, and I believe it's directed towards Miss, I want to pronounce her name correctly, June Blue Spruce.
Correct.
Yes, ma'am. You stated that whiteness expands when responding to Gus's question about whiteness. And it is to my understanding that white people at this current juncture are having difficulties with fertility. They're having low birth rates. So my question to you is, how exactly is whiteness expanding? Because to my understanding, white people are decreasing according to their own facts. Does that make sense, ma'am?
Yes, that's a really good question, and I want to clarify what I said.
Okay, thanks.
So, for example, I have ancestors who were Irish. When the Irish immigrated here, they were not considered to be white. Some of them were not even considered to be human, the way they were treated. But they basically bought into white supremacy sufficiently to be classified as white. Same thing happened with Italians, same thing happened with Germans, same thing happened with Jewish immigrants. So that's what I meant, is that the category of white used to be limited to a very specific slice of Northern Europeans. And as different waves of ethnic groups immigrated to the U.S., gradually they, quote, assimilated, unquote, into whiteness and were then called white. That's what I meant. It wasn't about birth rates or numbers of people. at all. Thanks for the question.
Did that answer your question, Moen Dallas?
It did. It but it inspired another question. If I could, if I can, I'll wait for other callers to get their questions in.
Oh, bravo. How about that? All righty. I'll come back then. Let's see. Our caller, last four digits, 9608. 9608. Did you have a question for Ms. Iverson? Ms. Blue Spruce, you should be with us as well. Maybe not. 9608. Try again. Okay. Should have you this time.
Greetings, Gus. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings to Gus, the host, callers, and listeners. My question is for both Ms. Blue Spruce and Ms. Iverson. Since neither of you speak for all white people, what is the motivating fear of the white people whom you share a kinship with to practice racism, white supremacy?
Can you repeat the question? I couldn't quite hear exactly what you said.
Yes. Since neither of you speak for all white people, what is the motivating fear of the white people whom you share a kinship with to practice racism, white supremacy?
That's a really good question. I think it's probably fear of losing privilege, losing that position that allows us to have a relatively comfortable life, food, shelter. You know, I think that's probably the thing that motivates people that I know.
Unless I'm mistaken, that was Ms. Iverson. Ms. Blue Spruce, did you want to respond to the same question?
No, that was, I'm sorry, that was June.
This is
June Blue Spruce
got
speaking. Yes. Yeah.
Ms. Iverson, did you want to respond to the same question?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you for your question. Two things come to mind. Yeah, fear of, I would say, not only privilege, but economic security, economic wealth, economic, you know, fill in the blank. That's one thing. The other thing is, I would say, not well. Three things, actually. Second one is fear of feeling. Fear of feeling. And not knowing who they are if they're not white.
Thank you, Gus. I would like to... go ahead, please.
Could I add, this is June Blue Spruce. Can I add something to that? Thank you, Lisa. Mm-hmm. I think there's a real fear of taking responsibility and of the reparations that are due. There's a real fear of feeling responsible for the pain and suffering and oppression that is being enacted.
Are white people responsible for this so-called pain and oppression?
Absolutely.
Gus, I'd like to remain on the line and ask a question later, please, sir.
That is, that's allowed. Much obliged for your question, sir. Let me see. Caller, victim of racism in New Jersey. Did you have a question for Miss Blue Spruce, Miss Iverson?
Hey, how you doing? Good evening, Gus, two guests. I have a question. When black people may complain about the system of white supremacy, it's often said, then leave, get out the country, or, you know, go back to Africa. So my question is, whiteness synonymous with being American, being that, you know, black Americans are one of the oldest groups in this country, fought in every war. But often when we present a problem that we are going through, people may say, get out, you know, go back to Africa. So is whiteness synonymous with being American?
Lisa, do you want to answer that one first, or?
Well, yeah, this is Lisa. I think that's the lie that's taught. I think that's the what inherent in your question, that's part of the problem. That's part of the lie. The country was created. The country was built, financed by enslavement and by colonialism. And the lie says, doesn't acknowledge that. So, I appreciate you very much, very much asking that.
Yeah, this is June, and I totally agree with that. That it's not, whiteness is not the definition of being American, but that's the belief, that's the confusion, that's the error that is really harmful. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That's my only question.
Thank you.
Our caller in California, did you have a question for Miss Iverson, Miss Blue Spruce? Caller in California should be on the vote line. Did you have a question? Just listening. Not hearing you. I don't know if you have your line muted, perhaps, or having maybe an audio issue. See if we have time. I can circle back around and double check. Maybe it's an audio issue or what have you. But caller in California, double check. Yes, not hearing. Just maybe you can even hang up and dial back in if it's an audio issue, but not hearing your audio for some reason. *61 for other folks if you have questions. I know few other folks said they had a second question. I'll get in a few book questions, and in fact, we can pull in one of our other authors as we get into a little bit of the book details. Let's see. I have to get the medical portion. We have med students, as I said, so I have to get that. Yeah, we'll get to the med portion first. Make sure I get that in. So, Miss Blue Spruce, I'm talking to her. This was, like I said, I'd totally forgotten that we had spoken on the phone and talked about the book and what was in the book and, you know, why that's important to her and what her grandparents did and all this. Like, so I started reading, like, oh my gosh, like, all came flooding back to me, savings and learning. So, her essay, warning, whiteness may be hazardous to your health. I'll ask about the title in a moment. I'll read a little bit. My family had a skeleton in its closet. Metaphors. This one will get you because the metaphor does come, but my family had a skeleton in its closet. The skeleton's name was Oscar. Granddad used Oscar to teach his anatomy students at Temple University Medical School the structure of the skeletal system, the names of the bones. I have no idea whose bones these were. I assume that this small person did not give consent. After Granddad died, Oscar lived with one or another of my aunts and uncles in Swarthmore, a suburb of Philadelphia, where I and my siblings and cousins grew up. On my first visit home after leaving for college, I was startled to find Oscar hanging in the closet of my old bedroom. I arranged my clothes around this shrouded form. I'm going to pause and go off subject just for one moment, just because Philadelphia is on my mind. Were you in the Philadelphia area circa May 1985?
No, I had moved out west by then.
Okay. Too far gone. When did you leave? Oh, yeah, you were gone before that, too. Yeah, way too far gone. Lots of
cool things. Actually left Philadelphia when I was 18, which is like 100 years ago. No, I left Philadelphia in the late 60s.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
never lived there again. But, I visited my family, but I never lived there again.
Okay. Lots of cool things happened, but that's way after you were gone. I wrote online as I was reading this. It would be impossible at this point because we've done thousands of programs, but it would be way more informative to listen to this program, The Cows, chronologically, so that you can hear things with these programs in the order that they came out. Way more informative. So if you were with us Monday, Guy Lancaster, white male, we talked about racism, white supremacy in Arkansas, his book All About White Violence. He said he had a white woman who contacted him and wanted to know what to do. She found a mummified Negro finger in her attic.
Oh, God.
With the newspaper clipping of a lynching with the finger. We talked about that on Monday, Delectable Negro. So that's in the forefront of my mind as I'm going to read this book.
Mm-hmm.
So I read this about Oscar. Now, once I catch this is not a metaphor. Oh, the metaphor is coming, but at least for right now, this is not a metaphor. This is like a for real skeleton. I have the finger in the forefront of my mind, and then book club plug again. So book club, Delectable Negro, Vincent Woodard, Top 10, Gusty Renegade, Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, White People Ignorant About Racism, Harriet A. Washington's Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on African Americans, 1865 to present. Long line of books. Chip Jones, who was just with us this year, The Organ Thieves, a pretty recent book about them stealing a black person's heart. I went to Harriet A. Washington, so I have Oscar, not the grouch, but Oscar's skeleton. So I go to Medical Apartheid, which we read. Harriet A. Washington, the great, writes, "More pork for the South. Yesterday morning, it was discovered that a barrel which had been put into the office of the Charleston Packet Line for the purpose of being shipped to Charleston contained ye bodies of two dead Negroes. The cask and its contents were sent up to the police office and placed in the dead house of the coroner. The barrel's contents were addressed to the professors of a medical school. Buckingham added that this was the fourth such discovery that month and that no further inquiry appears to have been made into the matter, as if it were altogether beneath the notice of the white men to trace out these traitors in the dead bodies of blacks. Black graveyards were the favored hunting grounds of the northern body snatchers. In 1829, John D. Godman, M.D., wrote of how on behalf of several Philadelphia brotherly love medical schools, he had secretly paid the manager of a public graveyard for the privilege of emptying the pits of about 50 to 85 cadavers a month during each dissecting season. The reference to a dissection season was pragmatic as well as academic. Before the advent of efficient preservative technology, corpses decayed quickly, except for those corpses that were pickled in whiskey for export. Bodies were exhumed during the cool of the academic year from fall through spring. Todd Savitt explains that blacks were well aware of this morbid seasonality, as evidenced by one elderly Virginia slave who, passing the medical school, shuddered and muttered, "Please God, I hope when I die, it'll be in the summertime."
Oh,
medical
wow.
Apartheid is in my top 10, along with Delectable Negro. Whew, must reads. But so I read all this, and I have the finger in the forefront of my mind from Monday, and I've already read Medical Apartheid, so I say, Oscar, and I say, man, that could be the remains of a black person. Miss Blue.
Absolutely. Bruce? Absolutely. Could be. Yeah.
I'm
chilling and shameful.
All that and then some. I will just add, I'm of the opinion that many black people do not know this at all. Just going back to that question about who is more informed about white supremacy racism, because most black people that I bump into have not read Medical Apartheid, Cal's listeners excluded. So this passage, this her whole report warning whiteness could be hazardous to your health. What were you hoping to accomplish, and even why is that the title, warning whiteness could be hazardous to your health?
Well, the essay talks about the ways that white supremacy, and in very specific terms, the actions of my grandfather, who, you know, for the sake of your listeners, my grandfather graduated from medical school in Philadelphia in 1899. He was quite old by the time my dad was born, and so that's part of why the generations in my family are so long. Anyway, he graduated from medical school. And at that point, you know, there were lots of different kinds of practitioners in American medicine. Medicine was way more diverse than it is now in terms of the type of practice and also who were the practitioners. And then the AMA commissioned this report that was funded by the Carnegie Foundation to supposedly improve the quality of medical education. And this man named Alexander Flexner went around to all the medical schools in the country, and he assessed them by certain criteria. Well, of course, you know, he came, there were by that time 7 medical schools that were black. And the reason that there were black medical schools is because the white run medical schools discriminated against black people. And, So Flexner went around and assessed the black medical schools and rated them as inferior to the white medical schools, and recommended that 5 out of the 7 close, and only 2 were spared, Howard and Mihari. And that led to a huge dearth of black physicians in the country, which of course led to a dearth of healthcare and lack of access to healthcare for black people, since most white doctors discriminated against black people. So my grandfather was an early member of the AMA. So in this case, you know, as is true throughout the system of healthcare, these actions led to a huge, hugely disproportionate amount of ill health and death among black people. So that's where the title came from. And then I go on in the essay to talk about a number of other instances, including Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment, in which basically white supremacy was deadly for black people.
That was I wrote online, I think literally, I spent the last year saying, oh, I'm so tired of hearing about Tuskegee. Like, there are many other illustrations of white people terrorizing black people in the medical industry. Like, Tuskegee, is there more current, events that could be used, historical events? Take your pick. Henrietta Lacks, lots that folks could pick from.
Right, right.
I literally just posted, I do not want to hear about Nurse Rivers or Tuskegee anymore, like, for a good 5 years. And then I went and I think I flipped the next page and you brought it up in the book. Like, it's like, I cannot believe this. Like, what in the world? Like, anything related to Tuskegee, like, that's all you have to let me find out. It's like, there's one page or one component of it that mentions Tuskegee, and I'm going to be two thumbs down for, like, years. I've heard so much of it. You, in non-Tuskegee related matters, you fast forward to, you already said you got out of Philadelphia by the 1970s. You are in California and working with the Black Panther Party. Now, again, for Cal's listeners, we talked about their medical programs. Lots of folks just boil down the Panther situation to berets and leather jackets. And they had ambulance programs in a number of places because of extensive white supremacy, racism, and black people not being adequately served. I want to get to one portion specifically, read a little bit, and then get your thoughts. So this is a little bit further in the essay. One of the groups that stepped up to provide community-based health care nationwide was the Black Panther Party. The BPP understood poor health and lack of health care to be one of many forms of social violence against blacks and other oppressed people. To carry out their mission of liberation, they needed to care for the bodies of black people. The Bobby Seale People's Free Medical Center opened in Berkeley in 1971, the year I arrived there. The Berkeley City Council provided some of the funding for all the clinics. Once a year, we would get together to develop and present a funding proposal and lobby the council to pass it. Part of my role in the collective involved working on that funding effort. We knew it was important to collaborate and not compete. Often, when we called meetings to strategize, only white women from the collective would show up. Like most white feminists of the time, we tended to look at everything through the lens of gender first. The Panthers with whom we worked on clinic funding were all men. We told ourselves that, once again, men were relying on women to get the work done. The reality, of course, was much more complicated than that. The BPP had grown quickly from a local organization to a major international political force with chapters all over the country. The federal government was determined to destroy the BPP by overt and covert means. Murders, legal charges, infiltration, agent provocateurs, propaganda. By 1971, its existence was threatened, as were the lives of several of its surviving leaders and followers. Support from key allies eroded following governmental concessions to black and anti-war activists and negative press coverage of the party. I'll stop there. Just one, I guess, can you give us a little bit more detail about your involvement in working with the Black Panther Party at this period of time, and even your assessment, your feminine, I guess I'll be specific, since you said white men before, that same specificity, your white feminist perspective on this time period, if you could kind of reflect on both.
Yeah, so I really didn't, I mean, I knew some things about the Panthers, obviously, but I didn't really understand the full picture of what they were dealing with at that time. I have learned a lot more in retrospect, in reading, in watching documentaries, in, you know, attending events. You know, there was a 50th anniversary of the Seattle Black Panther Party that was just a year or two ago. I think it was before, that must have been before the pandemic. So anyway, so I now know a whole lot more about what was going on for the Panther Party at that time than I did then. And, you know, I was pretty, pretty naive. This was the first political work I'd ever done. I was very invested in feminism. I didn't know a lot about what was going on for the Panthers. I had contact with them in the meetings. So I can't say I was really involved with them much beyond that. There were other people in the collective who I think were more knowledgeable and more connected to that community than I was. And I think that's pretty typical, frankly, of white feminists of the time. And even now, many white feminists don't have a deep awareness of racism and of their own racism or of our own racism. And at that time, I certainly didn't. So anyway, does that answer your question?
For sure. I'm just going back to my preemptive commentary at the beginning, because we again have this being talked about as not being aware or not being conscious. And I'm just of the opinion this is how white people practice racism. And that's pretty striking to be in. I mean, that's like the epicenter of so much of the activity.
Yeah.
We just read the biography of Geronimo Pratt. And that was, hey, he was visiting Oakland, like, this is happening and the city is involved. To not be curious about that. People are dying. They're having they had the shootout at the Berkeley campus. Like, all of this is happening right there. Mm-hmm. And to not have more curious, like, in my view, that is not a lack of an awareness. That is not a white feminist perspective. That is white people practicing racism, white supremacy.
Yeah.
Let's see. And I'm going to get one more and then
I don't disagree with that. I don't. I you know, absolutely.
Double negative. I point that out sometimes. I'm very specific about grammar just because I thought they told us in elementary school. I agree with that is stronger than I don't disagree. Those double negatives pop up frequently in talking to white people about racism, white supremacy, even in writing, which I point out in writing because, hey, they have editors for books. So, I mean, even the editor should be saying, hey, you got a double negative here. Take that out. That doesn't happen frequently in talking about white supremacy, racism. Last one I'll read from this this essay, warning, whiteness could be hazardous to your health. And then I'm going backwards to the foreword to the piece that Lisa Iverson wrote. This is a little bit further forward. Make sure I get the full sentence here. Okay. My first job out of school was on the neurosurgery floor of Seattle's Providence Hospital, run by Catholic nuns from the Sisters of Providence. The hospital was not a safe place to come out as a lesbian in 1978. When Dan White murdered Harvey Milk in San Francisco that November, one of the other LPNs, a short, thin, tough, older white woman, spat out, "He deserved it." No one disagreed. I didn't dare. I thought about it, and again, chronology. We just had a white woman on the program, Angie Schmidt. We were talking about her, We were talking about her book, Right of Way. And she was comparing the persecution of LGBTQ individuals to black people. And she brought up Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I said, there have been at least 260 different incidents of entire black towns being purged for a made-up reason, or you looked at a white woman or whatever. But more than 260 of these events have happened where, just on the basis of you being black, get out of here. You got 24 hours to leave or die. And we were talking to Angie Schmidt, and I said, can you think of or cite me one piece of evidence where that's happened one time in this part of the world, the United States, so-called, where individuals classified as white or anyone else went around and on the basis of someone being classified as lesbian or gay, transgender, whatever it is, all of the LGBTQ people, you have to be out of town or die in the next 24 hours. I asked her, I said, can you think of one example? And she was hemming and hawing. At first she said no, but then she said, I'm not an expert on all this and I can't think of one. I ask you the same question. Can you think of one example where an entire town has been purged of individuals just because they were classified, identified as LGBTQ?
No.
much of black. That's why I said sometimes it's appalling when you can't just get a clean, straight answer of that nature. I read this and I said, wow, Mike, the COINTELPRO information, I mean, we still don't have all the information about COINTELPRO and the numbers of black people who were killed. And even, let's be clear, there were black people who were victims of COINTELPRO, not because they came out, I'm loud and proud, I'm a Black Panther, or I'm with SNCC or SCLC or any other organization. There were black people who were victims of COINTELPRO just because they were black, and maybe it looked like you might have been at one of these meetings, or maybe we thought you were, maybe you have a name that's similar to someone in this organization. Not that you did anything, not that you had a cause or anything. To have that compared, I read this like, wow, I do not think individuals who are LGBTQ are anywhere close to subjected to the type of violence that individuals who are classified as white mete out to black and non-white people, but especially black people worldwide. Am I inaccurate, Ms. Blue Spruce?
Well, my intention in including that story was to describe part of my experience in that work situation. It was not to equate that oppression with racism and white supremacy. So if that's not clear in the piece, then that was not what I meant to do. I was just describing, you know, one thing that happened as part of that employment. And I think it helps explain why I was so reluctant to have a more open talk with Willie, which is the other part of the story, because I was so afraid of coming out. So, yeah. But there is no equivalence between the different kinds of oppression. And I might add, there are people that experience both. There certainly are LGBTQ people who are black and non-white people who experience both at the same time.
That is true. I just want to be clear for our listening audience, because that does happen so frequently, the conflation of the two, particularly in terms of white people, like our guest, Ms. Blue Spruce, their victimization, and particularly just white victimization on the whole. This whole passage about her fear of coming out in Seattle, to me, reads very much like white victimization. Somehow in conversations that are supposed to be about whiteness, as you say, what I call white supremacy racism, so much of it ends up drifting to white victimization somehow. Even this, I would say, is the same vein. I just, in the same essay where the COINTELPRO campaign is greatly minimized in terms of the violence that was meted out to black people, all types of black people, including Bobby Seale, and to then have this follow, to me, that read is the same type of conflation that I see on a regular basis when these subjects are discussed, almost predictably that type of conflation. I will backtrack, and then we have another author. I'll backtrack to Ms. Iverson. I'll nab our other author, and then when people get their other question in, we should have one of the other authors here as well, so you can get a third perspective. So I'm going out of order here just because I'm going in the direction that the reports came to me. This was the first one that I was told about, so that's the first one I read. Then I went backwards and read the forward. So now we flip all the way back to the beginning of the book, the forward put together by Ms. Iverson. Forward to Whiteness is Not an Ancestor, Essays on Life and Lineage by White Women. She includes some of the folks, well, actually, she starts off making a with the whole, as we explained, what is whiteness, explaining that. Then she goes a little bit further down. I thought this one was important because we've talked about this regularly. I'm reading. I realized how deeply my indoctrination in the innocence of white womanhood meant relying on white men to be solely responsible for the perpetrator roles of humanity in the American experience, namely slaveholder and colonizer. something we've talked about a lot, white women being removed. Can you give us a little bit more detail, Ms. Iverson, about your indoctrination into the innocence of white womanhood and how that applies to you specifically?
Sure. Thank you for asking. It was over the course of learning over the last couple of decades doing experiential work, group work, that brings into visibility these histories, how they're stored in the body. They're not, of course, they affect our mind. Of course, they affect our mind. But these histories are stored in the body. So it was over time, being with those experiences of working with my own experience of being a white woman and working with families, that I began to see how much the information that's stored in my body affects my mental perceptions and beliefs and thoughts and observations. And so yeah, that's what I would say right now.
I guess in countering this indoctrination, that's the word from the text that you use about the so-called innocence, yes, of white women, mm-hmm, what ways, yes, what behaviors did you begin to recognize that white women were engaging in to maintain racism, white supremacy?
Well, I would say a combination of both. It's what seeing what white women do and seeing what white women don't do. It's both and international, I guess, both in my individual life and, you know, up in daily living in my work, and then in our, as an American, you know, the absence in the news, the absence in national reporting, the assumption just seems to frequently have been that there hasn't been. It was last year that the beginning of articulation in a national way, the recognition, of course, our Karen meme, we can thank for helping to, you know, bring that to a national scale of attention, that of course white women have a place and a role. And so for me, all this had everything to do with what led me to, you know, invite this group of women to write about their whiteness in their own lives and in family histories, because this whole thing about what my background in 30 years of working with trauma, what I know about trauma that has to do with victim and perpetrator experience, it's usually the role of perpetrator that is most difficult to take responsibility for. And so my background in social work has been a part of what the lens that has contributed to bringing this book together and to be able to simply by what June and these other women have written about, to be able to say by what they've written, of course we're not innocent. None of us are innocent. And so that's what I would say.
Is it accurate then? Because you said it's difficult to accept that label as a perpetrator. Is it accurate to say that you, someone classified as a white woman, is it accurate to say that you are one of the perpetrators of white supremacy racism?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you think of a time? I have to ask this one to Ms. Blue Spruce as well. Can you think of a time where someone who is not white accused or suspected you of practicing racism?
Including right now?
Sure, sure.
yeah. I mean, here we are, right? Yes.
Can you think of anything other than this evening? Has anyone before this evening accused you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Can you remember a specific, like the details of one time?
Well, I told the story of when I was a child. That's clear. There was a recent example of somebody, I sent an email about something to someone about these events, and she's a non-white person and was angry that I had sent her that email. Wasn't her work to do. There's plenty of other examples, but those are two that come to mind right now.
Wow. With the email situation, you said she was upset that you had sent her this email and it wasn't her work to do. Did she like specifically say that she thinks you were doing this because she's not white or she's, a black person or whatever?
No, but that was the message.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'll have to ask Ms. Blue Spruce. I will ask the same question to you. I just want to make sure I don't lose this. This was
Ms. Blue Spruce that just answered.
Oh, my fault. I confused again. Got confused again.
It's okay. It's okay. I should have identified myself.
Having multiple folks, told you all, makes my brain computer work a lot. Same question then, which I thought Ms. Iverson would do it again to her the real time. Ms. Iverson, any non-white people, have they ever suspected or accused you of practicing racism?
I've been asking myself that question since you asked it of June, and I don't think anybody has directly accused me of such. I'm not at all saying that I haven't been or am not. I can't speak on behalf of if somebody has thought that I have been, but no, I'm not recalling a situation that I can give you an example of.
Okay. That's more common. The white guests that we've had on the program, Ms. Iverson's response, where most white people have said no, and they've qualified and said, hey, I'm not saying that someone didn't think that, but they just didn't verbalize it to me, or maybe they told someone else, or maybe they just kept it to themselves, but they have not verbalized it to me. That's been more typical than Ms. Blue Spruce, where she said yes and was able to give specific examples. So for Ms. Iverson, this is from the foreword. Backing up a little bit, just to make sure I can give full context for the quote. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I have to go back a little bit. What we don't face faces us? Consider that the 2016 election, resulting in Donald Trump's installation in the White House, brings into sharp relief the roles and undeniable difficult truths in the American soul metaphor. Trump is the modern manifestation of the slaveholder, another metaphor, the colonizer, the breaker of treaties. He is unmasked genocide, metaphor, boasting of his blessing to murder in public. Manifest destiny, renamed as real estate developer. He is the result of a country absent of fair elections in a democracy owned by corporations. He claims innocence as a victim or rescuer, never taking responsibility for being a perpetrator. That word again. He is without need to apologize, since to him, mistakes were not made and harms remain unseen. He lies about money, how his family made it, and his unpaid debts. He is entitled and acts without consequence. He is a declaration of independence for white men personified. He is the shadow of our country, metaphor. He is whiteness without humility, missing his ancestors. Now, I know our, a lot of our listeners, especially while he was still in the White House, a lot of our listeners thought, wow, it's so peculiar. Like, so many white people, like, will target and address President Trump as a racist, or even they'll say a white supremacist frequently. Like, wow, that's odd. Like, they don't tend to do that most of the, like, even a lot of white people right now are not calling John Gruden a racist. They'll say a lot of things, but they won't call him a racist. And I just thought, one, he seems to have been an easier target than others for some reason. Two, I wanted to ask specifically, Ms. Iverson, what do you make, if Trump is all of these things, what do you make of President Trump getting so much support from white women voters both times around? He got over 50% even in the election that he lost to Joe Biden. What do you make of that?
Yeah, what I make of that has everything to do with what led me to do this book, which is that there's a long history of associating white women with innocence. And the facts are anything but that. So, white women have everything to do, not only with him getting elected and everything that's happened over the last 4 or 5 years, everything that continues to happen, but also in the larger, you know, hundreds years old history.
Would you say that's an example of white women voting with their interest of white supremacy, racism at the forefront?
Yeah. Yes, I would. And feeling innocent while they're doing it.
Wow. Why? Just before I transition, what do you mean when you say that? Feeling innocent while they do it. What do you mean?
Well, the history. There's a history of.
Sorry, there's a background. I thought that was on my line. I was like, where's that coming from? Sorry about that. If we can get that again. You said there's a history.
That's okay. Yeah, it's just the larger histories that we're talking about that has to do with white supremacy and privilege being baked into it, entitlement being baked into it, and assumptions, a lot of assumptions baked into it.
As someone who bakes often vegan treats, I can appreciate a good baking metaphor anytime, but that would be another one. I just point that out because if we're talking, and even beyond baking, privilege, that is a word for more than a decade on this broadcast. I have told non-white listeners not to use that term. If what we're talking about is terrorism, as when Miss Blue Spruce, when she says, man, we got this skeleton Oscar in the attic. These may be the remains of a black person. That is not privilege. Use words that accurately reflect what we are talking about. White supremacy, racism, terrorism. But minimizing metaphors, they have a tendency of greatly minimizing the perpetrated terrorism and really barbarism of individuals classified as white. If that's what we're talking about, like grave robbing that went on for centuries, if that's what we're talking about, mummified fingers that have been preserved, even that to the shame, because that's the same thing Guy Lancaster said. That's in your work a lot too, about shame and guilt, where he said, hey, I would have a hard time imagining that you've had a mummified finger in the attic for decades and somebody didn't know this, and that somebody felt some sort of authentic shame or guilt about this. I mean, hey, put it in the trash. We don't even have to think of it again. We don't have to risk somebody stumbling over this and having to explain and all the rest. It was kept as a keepsake. That would strongly suggest that there's some sort of value to practicing racism, white supremacy, and even having a mummified Negro finger in the attic for decades. I said I was going to ask one, and then I'll get, because we had one other author on. We never have three white people on a program at a time, like unprecedented. But there are 12 different folks who participated, and I did say the more the merrier. One of the other co-authors of the report, I can give out the specific title. So this one... make sure I go through. There we go. In the shadow of Mount Evans, that's also a metaphor, living in a lineage of genocide, white privilege, and intergenerational healing. That one is written by Ann Hayden. I think we have Ms. Hayden with us as well. Is that true? Maybe not. I thought I saw her on the line. Are you with us, Ms. Hayden? Maybe she's just listening in. Maybe she didn't want to take any questions. She just wanted to hear what you all were going to contribute. Not hearing if you had a hand up or if you were wanted to contribute, but I thought we had Ms. Hayden with us as well. Let's see. I will make sure I nab folks, other folks who dialed in with a question. Please don't wait until the last moment if you have a question that you would like to ask either Ms. Iverson, Ms. Blue Spruce. We might have Ms. Hayden here. Maybe we don't. Let's see. The person who dialed in 1159, if you had a question. Last four digits, 1159.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners, and greetings to the guests. I'm the caller who had a technical difficulties earlier. My question for the two guests is, would you be willing for your future publications or edits to your publications that you already have to promote the concept of justice, which is guaranteeing no one is allowed to be mistreated and those who need help receive constructive help? Would you be willing to promote this concept in your future publications?
Yes. I mean, without knowing anything more than what you've just asked, you know, without having any more of a context, yes.
This is a concept from Neely Fuller Jr. So I will be looking forward to your next publication and looking forward to seeing that in there.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other guests?
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
There are callers on the line.
What is going on?
Maybe there is a disturbance in the signal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mo from Dallas. I have a question for Ms. Iverson. I hope Gus excuses me for taking liberty. Ms. Iverson, are you still on the line now?
Yep, I sure am. Hello, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, ma'am. Thank you for coming to the program. It's kind of a list. I have three questions that are yes or no, and then I have one question that has a yes or no, and then it requires an explanation.
Muted. Unmuted.
Okay. First question, would you agree that authority figures should not have sexual contact with their subordinates, ma'am? Like a college professor and a student, or boss employee? Okay, thank you. Would you agree that a white person, no matter the gender, has more power in the system of white supremacy than a black person?
In the white supremacy system, yes.
Yes, ma'am. Have you ever had sexual physical contact with a black person?
Not your business. I don't talk publicly about who I've had sexual relationships with in any context.
I understand, ma'am. I apologize for that. My final question. Under the system of white supremacy, would you agree that that black people should end all sexual contact with white people until the system of white supremacy is replaced with a system of justice, because we are their subordinates in that system?
I'm going to have to give that I would have to give that question the time it deserves for a good answer. And so that's all I can say about that question right now. Generally, I would say that, yeah, that's all I can say about that right now.
Okay. But just for clarification, you do agree though that, you previously, with their subordinates, though, correct?
Generally.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. I'll mute my line. Hopefully Gus is back. If not, anyone else with any questions?
Am I being heard? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
You're heard.
Oh, okay. That is crazy. I was right. I was trying to get a question and... I guess I just wasn't being picked up for some reason. Wackiness. Much obliged. I was able to hear, I guess, the questions where Mo was able to get his questions in. Thank you for waiting patiently and taking up the space so we weren't wasting time. Did I hear correctly someone, I guess you asked about sexual intercourse, and the response, I guess, was I don't discuss sexual activity publicly. Did I hear that correctly? And if so, who said that?
This is Lisa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't disclose my sexual activity in public settings, no.
Okay, just trying to be sure about what I heard. We had someone who didn't get to ask a question at all. The caller at 4499, actually calling out of Pennsylvania. How about that? Did you have a question for Ms. Iverson or Ms. Blue Spruce?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, my question is, should black people expect to go under slavery from letting white women and white men through LGBT and feminism select our political preference, as if saying, we love jail, we love being shot, and they go back to being white, but we didn't select being a minority. They chose to be a minority, and they can go back to being white, but while they're choosing to be a minority, they can campaign and do very terrible policies for minorities and then say, we're white, and then we're backing black people, will be back enslaved. There won't be any feminism. There won't be any LGBT. There will just be minorities in chains that feminists and LGBT policies that they put in for minorities while under the minority umbrella. That's the end of my question.
Ms. Boosters, I guess we'll start with you and get everybody's response. Did you want to answer his question?
I'm not sure I want to answer that question. I think there's a lot of assumptions in that question that I don't agree with. So I sort of don't know where to start with answer. I wasn't even sure that it was a question. It sounded like a more of a comment or an opinion to me. So I guess I'm not totally clear on what the question is. What
do you
asking?
Think we could be slaves again? When we become slaves again, I'm pretty sure LGBT won't be in chains and feminists will not, well, white feminists will not be in chains. What I'm saying is, there's black LGBT, which will be in chains, and there's white LGBT, which they can choose whether they're LGBT or white. What I'm saying is, while they're choosing to be minorities right now,
we are kind of drifting off into speechifying. I have asked folks just to question. So if you could kind of put your statement into a question.
I got it. Do you think we could be, black people could be back in slavery, under letting LGBT and feminists under our umbrella of being minorities? And they have the most power to, you know, put our policy. They're the policy leaders under the minority umbrella. If you go to civil rights, LGBT rights, civil rights for the umbrella of black people and feminists. But the point I'm making is, do you think we could be slaves again under this here umbrella of minority, which minorities, black minorities don't run, but it's LGBT and feminists run our minority policies? Today, do you think we could be slaves again? That's my question.
I guess, did that clarify the question, Ms. Blue Spruce? Because you said you wanted them to kind of restate. Did that clarify the question? Or
so I want to say that being LGBTQ is not a choice. I will say that it's not necessarily easily identifiable visually the way being black is. So I want to be clear about that. And I also want to be clear that I do not think that these forms of oppression are equal or the same.
Should we all be under the same umbrella?
No. I mean,
that's what I'm, okay, I agree.
No.
Thank you. I agree.
No.
I just think LGBT and feminists are writing policies for the minority. And I think that is criminal because most feminists and LGBT, if they're white, they can go back to being white. If you're black, you're stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have status being white, even though I'm a lesbian, I'm queer, I experience impacts because of that, but I'm white, so I don't experience the impact of racism.
If someone calls you something or you get something, you can always say, I'm just a regular white woman. What are you talking about? As a black male, I can't say I'm a white male. What are you talking about? I'm going to always be a minority in the visual.
Like, right. If you're there is
LGBT
a difference.
Or you're a feminist and you're a white woman or a white man, you have to say, hey, I'm a feminist. Hey, I'm LGBT. No one's going to shoot you in a car. No cop is going to shoot a white feminist. No cop is going to shoot an LGBT.
That part is not true. There's plenty of violence against LGBTQ.
Well, hold on. LGBTQ.
It depends. I mean, there are people who are more obviously queer than other people. I happen to look pretty average. And so people looking at me wouldn't necessarily know I was a lesbian. My wife, however, is quite visually identifiable.
Black people can be slaves again under the umbrella with feminists and LGBT. Do you think we can be slaves again? That's my question.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. All I can say is I know that white feminists and white queer people do oppress people of color. True. And no, we should not speak for black people. We should not speak for non-white people, and we should not establish policy for black people and non-white people. So if that answers your question, that's all I can say. That's as far as I can go with this one.
Much obliged to our caller in Pennsylvania. Umbrella, even though that was his question, umbrella is also a metaphor. Just about being precise with what we're talking about is very important. Our caller at 9608, you said you had another question before you waited patiently, sir. Did you want to get your question in?
Yes, sir. My question is for Ms. Blue Spruce and Ms. Iverson. Have you ever blamed non-white people for their incorrect behavior without also blaming the system of white supremacy as being the greatest promoter of that non-correct behavior?
Start with Ms. Iverson on that one. Did you hear his question, ma'am?
Yes. Thank you for your question. I'm thinking about it, checking my memory. I could absolutely be mistaken or not remembering. I don't remember blaming any person of color for their behavior. I do tend to, for whatever reason, I'm wired in a way that I do. Ever since I was a kid, I tended to think about the bigger picture. So I think I've been thinking about the system for quite a while. So I'm going to have to say no, and I could be mistaken, but that's the truth.
And this is June Blue Spruce, and I can't remember an instance of having done that. So I would say no.
Much obliged. That answered his questions. I think we got all the folks who called in, just making sure we don't miss any folks before get ready to let our guests enjoy the rest of their evening. I did want to make sure.
Okay.
We'll get whoever that is. I did want to make sure that I call in California. Gotcha. I did want to make sure I asked the both of you in the work, your studies, analysis of this problem. Have you seen any evidence that individuals classified as white are going to voluntarily discontinue the practice of white supremacy racism? Ms. Blue Spruce, we'll get you both. Ms. Blue Spruce, any evidence white people are going to stop doing this voluntarily?
I'm thinking. I think some will.
I think as a whole, it's, you know, I don't know what, if you ask me what a non-voluntary end to white supremacy would be, I can't describe what that would be. But I think for many people that will, they will not give up white supremacy voluntarily.
White people, that, and that's important, extremely. That's like kind of at the forefront of how I evaluate books like this and anyone who classifies themselves as white. When they go about to talk about this problem, like, that would have to be very central to how we think about this. If white people are not going to voluntarily desist, yes, we will might maybe have to spend more time thinking about what does a non-voluntary end to the practice of racism, what does that look like? And apparently we might need to start, you know, getting into details and specifics if that's the case. But we'll see. If you, maybe you are a minority opinion. That's another word that I use caution about. Ms. Iverson, have you seen any evidence, your studies, your analysis of this problem, that white people are going to voluntarily desist from the practice of racism, white supremacy, like a substantial number of people classified as white?
No. Not a substantial number. No. Sadly.
Just trying to be accurate in how we analyze things. Very important, especially for the folks who talk about hope in all of this, like very mitigated hopes, or more, I'm much more of the opinion we should have our thinking in line with reality. That's how you get problems solved. Our caller in California, do you want to get your question in, sir?
Yes, thank you. I think I only heard one answer earlier, so I'll ask again. Would you be willing in your future publications and any edits to your older publications to promote the concept of a system of justice? This concept comes from Louis Fuller Jr., which means guaranteeing no one is allowed to be mistreated and those who need help receive help.
Yes, this is Lisa.
Yeah, I think we both said yes to that.
Oh, okay. Awesome. I look forward to seeing that in your next publication. Thank you.
Thank you.
Friend, I don't think I missed any other hands up. Looks like everybody was satisfied, got their questions in.
Yes, I have a question.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. But this one's for Miss, I don't want to mispronounce her name. I think it's Blue Spruce.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. Earlier in the program, when I asked my question about whiteness expanding, you said that other cultural groups like the Irish bought into whiteness. Correct, ma'am?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
Thank you. My question is, what is the price of admission for whiteness? Bought into whiteness is a metaphor. I would like for that to be explained if possible. So what is the price of admission for whiteness?
That's a really good question. The price is, in the case of the Irish, your language?
In general.
Your culture. Okay. Language, culture, often identification with people of your own economic class, opposition to systems of oppression. I mean, I can think of specific examples of all of that, but it's a high price.
Thank you, ma'am. I guess if Ms. Iverson would like to respond to the question, I would appreciate that. But I have no more questions. Thank you, guys, for the program. Thank you, guests.
Thank you. Honestly, the word that the word that's with me is humanity.
Could you repeat that, ma'am? I don't think I heard you clearly.
The to really to buy into whiteness for white
yes,
people.
Yes, ma'am. The proclamation.
Yeah, the price of it is your own humanity.
Could you clarify that?
Yeah, I guess what I mean is that it is such a horrific history for the U.S. It's such a horrific history that we have, the trauma history as a country, to be in denial about it for white people. To be unable to really grasp how awful it is, what everything that we're talking about means the price is about being disconnected from one's humanity. And I think that's really what the case has been for the last. I think that's what the history is and how it kept going and how we got here and what's still happening. And yeah.
Gus, I know the guests have to go. Can I just get one question and it'll be fast and closing?
Concise question. Let's hear a concise question.
Yes. How you doing, guest? Okay. Does this show make you two feel uncomfortable? And have you ever had these kind of questions presented to you by non-white black people? Does the line of questioning make you uncomfortable? And does this, you know, are you used to this kind of question from black people?
This is Lisa, and I would say yes. Yeah. It's been uncomfortable, and no, I'm not used to it. Thank you for asking. And thank you for having us.
Yeah, this is June, and I would say also yes. I have had moments of feeling uncomfortable for sure, and. You know, I'm not used to having conversations like this where people are asking me these questions directly. But I have done a lot of reading where I've seen these sorts of questions posed to white people. So, you know, it's a different experience to have them asked to me directly.
Okay. Thank you. And okay, one more question since you gave that answer and I'm done. But do you think that's the root cause of the problem, that people are not honest when it comes to talking about racism?
I think that's one of the root causes, absolutely.
Okay.
Glad you were able to get your question in. I guess before you all depart, I've heard that from a few, or many I'll say, of the white guests that we've had on the program over the years, in terms of something about this experience making them uncomfortable, like, I am a nobody, I can't impact any white person's employment, or, you know, disrupt their dessert plans, or, you know, weekend parties or anything, make trouble for them getting on a flight, disrupt book sales, like nothing. Just chatting on a podcast for like 2 hours, basically. I don't grasp what's uncomfortable, especially over a phone. Like, this is not in person or anything. Like, you know, whatever. We chatted about, you write books about racism. Like, I don't really grasp why that would make a white person uncomfortable. Like, I guess if we could get that as kind of a parting response. Ms. Blue Spruce, what about this would be uncomfortable? You're just sitting on a phone talking about racism as a powerful white woman. Why would this be an uncomfortable experience?
What made me the most uncomfortable were some of the assumptions about LGBTQ people, I'll be honest. And I think speaking frankly about difficult topics can be uncomfortable. It doesn't mean I don't want to do it. I'm here and I'm glad to be here. But I think it can be uncomfortable. So I'm honestly saying that. I'm not feeling like my life is threatened or I'm going to have a miserable evening or anything like that. It's just sometimes uncomfortable to talk about these topics. And, you know, so an honest answer was yes.
Okay. Ms. Iverson?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I tend to think that conversation and talking and listening are really important. And also the history, again, that we're all talking about, it's rooted in trauma. So what's uncomfortable for me has to do with a sense of trauma, the larger field of trauma that all of us here in this conversation are in connection with in one way or another. And my experience in life is that, and here too, is that there's a difference between solving something and healing something. And for me, I think all this history, again, it's, we can't solve the past. We can't do it. It's not possible. But what it means to make a climate for healing is what I feel really interested in. And I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to choose to be part of a conversation like this and others too, to be reminded of that they're not one and the same, that solving a problem is not the same thing as healing wounds. So I'm grateful for our time together, and I'm very appreciative for every single one of you and every single one of us here, and for all of our ancestors, without whom every single one of us wouldn't be here, without all of our ancestors. So I'm grateful for all of our ancestors that have made it possible for us to be here, and I hope it has a good effect. That's my prayer, is that it has a good effect for all of our kids and grandkids, all of them, all of them. Thank you.
That was Miss Lisa Iverson. Price of admission is a metaphor, as is climate for healing. Just point that out. Details. When we get down to solving problems, even healing, you have to get to details. And frequently, that is what I've noted, is one of the major problems. There is lots of rhetoric, especially when individuals classified as white. One of the main ways that they practice white supremacy racism is deception. You have to be very careful being precise, specific. They say the devil is in the details. In racism, white supremacy, you have to watch the metaphors and analogies and that type of thing, because you start to move away from being precise and just off into a lot of rhetoric where it can be very easy to confuse and deceive people. Racist white supremacists, they are extraordinary at using words to deceive and confound non-white people. Our guests for the evening contributed different essays to the report. Whiteness is not an ancestor, not white people, not white supremacy racism, but whiteness. Essays on life and lineage by white women. And they, just pointing it out for specifics, I always, always capitalize the W in white, and that's the only so-called racial classification that I capitalize. B, I never capitalize the B in black. Never. They have a lowercase w for the W in white, and that's the only major word meaning something besides on or and. That's the only major word in the title that doesn't have a capital letter. Just pointing out details are important. That's the exact opposite of what Gus does. But that's the book we have discussed. June Blue Spruce, Lisa Iverson, White Women. Much obliged for your time this Wednesday evening. Maybe we'll get to chat it up again and discuss some more of your views, give our listeners more chance to ask questions. Much obliged for your time, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you, Gus.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Much obliged. Context of white supremacy. Two guests, like, man, and I said, I believe Ann Hayden was here. Now, I don't know if she wanted to just listen in or if she was going to contribute a little bit. But, man, it's like work. You have to, we don't just have one person, so I'm just talking to them and asking questions and all of that. Like, two people, that's a lot more to remember the different responses and everything. And I would say specifically with white guests, because we had the same phenomenon happen, I think, in like the springtime. We had three guests on the program. Two of them were white. One of them was non-white. Where you ask one person a question, and so the other people, they can hear and adjust and, you know, kind of feel things out, where that wouldn't, you know, be the case if it was just one guest. But either way, hopefully folks got some constructive information. Works, man, makes my brain computer work a little bit. We have extra guests on the program, more than one guest on the program. Anywho, hopefully that stood out, since I said that in advance. Metaphor, even with price of admission for the club, what I thought of immediately when those responses were given, because she said humanity, and even to me that's another metaphor, what I thought was the book that was mentioned on the program Monday, where I said it's so much more informative if you listen chronologically. The book that was mentioned Monday on the program was Lynching to Belong, which is exactly about so-called immigrants. What do you have to do to be lynching to belong? That's the title of the book. I looked it up, Betsy, once we got off the program. I think it is written by a black author. Not that that's, you know, whatever. But I think one of our callers in Michigan was requesting information to that end. But that was just this past Monday. All I can say, I'll hear what you all have to say, folks who tuned in with questions. One thing that I will say, I think white guests only. That said that for a long time, I would much rather have white people on, even if it's more than one white person, and ask them questions, get their thoughts, opinions, views on things, as opposed to victims of racism, who generally are very confused about white supremacy racism. The problem is individuals classified as white. I think Ms. Iverson, the perpetrators, identified herself as one. Like, yeah, we should be talking to them and getting better asking them questions. To that end, writing out your questions can be helpful. That's something that I do just to make sure that you can be clear. I know sometimes, even for myself, when I first began asking white people questions, just writing them out can be super helpful to make sure that you're saying things the way that you want, to make sure that you don't give them as much wiggle room. Like when I ask the question about how did you learn to function, and they were moving away from that, just in how you ask your question sometimes can reduce their opportunities to be deceptive. Doesn't even mean that you have to ask yes-no questions. How did you learn to practice racism is not a yes-no question. But just how you use words can limit their ability to be deceptive. Price of admission metaphor. I guess one other thing I'll get in and then we'll get our listeners. I thought it was so important when June Blue Spruce, when giving detail about what made her uncomfortable, the very first thing that she said was the assumptions about her being LGBTQ, which goes back to what I said about white people. So consistently things get back to them being victims somehow. That's what that sounded like to me. In terms of saying that was the thing that made her most uncomfortable. And then she just moved from there. But I always question that, like, are you serious? You are classified as white in a series in a system of white supremacy and you're on a phone. You could be in a hot tub. You could be getting a massage, a foot. What was the white woman who down in Florida? She was at the spa and did the Zoom call for her job interview, getting her pedicure. You could be doing that for all we know. Why? What is upsetting, unsettling? Even if someone suspects you of practicing racism, white supremacy, which did happen today, but I mean, so what? Like, are you going to be able to put me on the no-fly list now? Always question that. Anywho, write your questions down. Can be very helpful just to make sure, even for yourself, to make sure you're clarifying what it is exactly that you are trying to ask. Let's see. Before I forget, I was going to say it when they were here. They talked about being at the Black Panther reunion, the 50-year celebration, I guess. I was at one of the Black Panther celebrations that they had here in Seattle. I think I was at the 40-year reunion that they have. I think I talked about this before. Aaron Dixon was there, and mostly white people, but whatever. This was pre-Rona, and it was on the campus of the University of Washington. Aaron Dixon was there. He got up and spoke. He was a member of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. He gets up. He talks a little while, blah, 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 blah. They have a really nice spread. Like, this is back when I ate, like, I was carnivorous. They had cheese and all the rest of this stuff and a big fruit bowl and all that, like, really plush setup. So he gives his talk or whatever, and they had like a whole weekend of events and all this stuff and murals up all over campus, University of Washington. So after the end, I get up, I go to Mr. Aaron, and I say, Aaron Dixon, I go to him, hey, how you doing? And I said, man, I don't know. It's a lot of white people here for this event. Like, it's just, I don't really think that they have changed. Like, we still have the same problem. But she said, oh, yeah, racism's still a problem. Alive and well, as they say. I said, I just don't think that these white people are serious about changing anything. They're hanging, look at all the fruit that they've got. Cheese. They're chilling. The cheese was good. And he says, things have changed so much, and we'll have to sit down, young brother, and blah, blah, blah. I said, really? You think that they would be here chilling and listening to you, like, just feet propped up? And wow, this is great. I remember, if you know, racism were really in jeopardy. And he gave me like such a, he gave one of those lean back, right? He did the lean back like, oh, you're one of those radical Negroes. And I remember, I think the cows, we weren't even on at the time. We had been taken off the air. So we had broadcast in 2007 for like 2 months, kicked off the air. And it took us like 18 months to get back on the air. So this was in that 18-month interim. So he does the lean back on me, Mr. Dixon, like, oh, you're one of those militant Negroes. And so I, at this point, like, what? Wait, I recognize that look immediately, like, uh-oh, he's giving me the militant Negro look. And I'm kind of like, wait a minute, you just were up talking about running around Seattle with guns and shooting your arm off and COINTELPRO and all the rest of this. Like, I'm not doing any of that. I don't have a slingshot. I came in and got some fruit, cheese. hey, I'm just saying something about this seems a little insincere, maybe. That's all I'm questioning, and I'm getting the militant Negro stare. Like, it was, I will never forget. Like, I've been in that category ever since, but I remember that moment. To this day, it was kind of like me and him for a moment. All the other folks were drifted off doing other things, chatting around the room and all the rest of it. And we were right at the front of the auditorium. And he gave me that look like, uh-oh, not going to spend too much time around you. And he didn't. And Bobby Seale was here, I believe, the next day. They had all kinds of events. Bobby Seale was here the next day. He gave a talk. And I remember it was a white woman right outside Seattle Central Community College was where this was, right on Broadway, no less. We're right outside. Bobby Seale finishes. The white woman said, wow, with the chuckle, he was funny and entertaining. Victim of white supremacy, Bobby Seale. And I said, wow, I hope if I talk about racism, white supremacy, if any suspected racists, if they hear me, I hope that at minimum they do not say, wow, that Gus is funny and entertaining. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Any of the folks who are with us have commentary that they wanted to share, what they heard from Lisa Iverson and June Bluespruce.
Yeah, Gus. I want to say, you know, you're definitely not going to be labeled as funny. You know, every suspected racist has a story of either getting mugged by a Negro or have an example of some form of reverse discrimination. So I suspect the cows will be used as a example of homophobia, of all the assumptions that was made about homosexuality on its program. But again, that last question, my observation, you know, a lot of times these white guests, they are not serious. They are just, you know, like writing about racism is just something to do, like writing a Harry Potter book or writing the last installment of Game of Thrones. Not serious about solving this problem. And again, you know, I called the show yesterday, and, you know, again, I still believe in your policy of white guests only, and I'm definitely convinced that black people are more confused because it's logical, because we have the problem, they don't. So, you know, why should they be in a rush to solve this problem? But, that last answer, I was waiting for you to queue up buckets and buckets of words, because that's all I heard when they responded to my last question.
It would have been apropos, absolutely. It was a little off on the switchboard today. I got disconnected myself. Not the best switchboard day, but it definitely would have been fitting for the conclusion. Incidentally, that Lisa Iverson, like at the very beginning, like I feel like she was ghastly deceptive at the very beginning. and the very conclusion of the broadcast. When I asked, who do you think is more confused? And she said, there's no confusion about the problem. That is appalling. Like, totally 1,000% appalling. Like, for a billion different reasons. Like, you know, non-white people do not have a clue about what is happening on this planet. Like, the details. Even the folks who might be kind of leaning in the correct direction. All of that notwithstanding. And then she gets to the end about, she didn't even answer the question. She drifts off into her, like, rhetoric about healing and a climate for healing and all this nonsense. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. That is not even addressing the question of, and even that, because I think her more so than June Blue Spruce, to have to keep reeling you back in with, this is what the question is, you didn't answer the question. She even got an attitude at the beginning, like, if you don't like the answer. Nobody said anything about not liking the answer. You didn't even answer the question. That was the important one about how were you taught to function as a white person, and especially in relation to black people. And that was when she got off on, well, there was no space for me as a white woman. There was no space for me in communication, all of that. What does that have to do with, and that this was white men, what does that have to do with how you are supposed to function? That's just talking about, yeah, how you don't have a space here or there. That's not at all talking about what you are supposed to do. Even if you want to get into what you are not supposed to do, like, let's get to those behaviors specifically. That's even sounding like you're drifting into some victimization, woe is me as a white woman in patriarchy type of a thing. Like, I thought her conduct stood out, especially the LGBTQ thing at the end. That was same thing with the victimization, same thing. But I thought Miss Iverson's conduct or responses were especially what I would expect from a white supremacist at a number of points during the broadcast. Let's see. Oh, and even that, like, the person that dialed in with his question about the umbrella and all that metaphor, like, wow. I don't know if that person normally listens to the cows or not, but I certainly do not encourage the use of the term minority. But that they would take that and that would end up representing the entire cows, as opposed to, let's listen to the responses that these white women gave beyond or before we even got to that question. Anywho.
You know what? Another thing, Gus, I mean, even though that question wasn't, like, you know, concise, it was, you know, I still understood, you know, what he was trying to articulate, you know. So, again, that's a prime example when you say stick to questions, giving suspected racist wiggle room. Did we lose Gus?
Was there someone else that they have commentary to share?
Yeah, I do. I was hoping and expecting the having two white people. I was expecting a lot of constructive information, but it seems like I personally got a lot of I just sense a lot of deception. The two women who are here. I do hope, and we'll be checking to see if they follow up on promoting the system of justice. The caller from Dallas, he came up with a great question that I wish. I had time to ask, but it will be another staple question of mine. And that question he came up with is, what should non-white people do globally to stop white people from practicing white supremacy? And even if with the deception that they displayed, even as asking that question probably would have been met with more deception, but it still would have been interesting. But I appreciate your effort, Gus, and handling two white women on the air could not be easy. Meet my line.
Workout for the brain computer, for sure. Much obliged, sir. Any other folks have observations, commentary that they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I would like to say first that thank you for the callers. My brain computer was not equipped to handle two white people at the same time. I think I noticed, I did arrive to the program late. I wish I came on time. I would have had a better understanding when I did structure my questions. What I did notice is I feel like they played off of each other's responses to certain questions to answer questions directed towards themselves. Like when one was uncomfortable with answering a specific question, so was the other one. Or they would answer it in the same style. I did notice that. I would like to say there are certain parts that I did hear that I completely reject and disagree with. No. But it was a I picked up a few, how do I structure my sentences now? I know not to use metaphors as much, or especially talking to white people. I'm still learning this language. I did restructure my questions, and I do write my questions, and I also do encourage other participants in the program to write down your questions. Thank you for the program. Also, I did, I noticed that the LGBT, I forget which guest mentioned the fact that she was uncomfortable with being questioned or about it or that being brought up. It was confusing to me because the LGBT community is so proud and strong. And with her being, I guess, a historian of sorts, you would believe that she would be well versed in her community, her people, her history, her things of the sort, et cetera. And you know, to not want to, you know, stand up for them and defend, like, it was confusing. Like how you could be a victim for. I don't even know how to finish this series of sentences. I need my line. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. I am still learning myself in terms of language and asking questions and word choice and all that. Like, that is, you know, hey, work in progress. But yes, they're hopefully just the broadcast this evening, metaphors. And I saw that with Miss Iverson specifically. She uses a lot of metaphors. Like, she has a TED Talk, and oh my gosh, it's just metaphor after metaphor, which is the way she was talking this evening, metaphor after metaphor. And I feel like that is the most dangerous because nothing is specific. Like if we're talking about, she even said that. She said there's a difference between solving problems and healing, whatever that means, and being a part of a climate for healing. That's a metaphor. I don't even know what you're talking about. And even if we just get back to logic, how do you heal if the terrorism is ongoing? I don't even know what you're talking about, saying things that are in the past and all the rest of it. White supremacy racism is current right now. It's difficult to heal if you're continually being injured anew. We would have to solve that problem and then get to the healing.
Gus, can I add to that statement you just said? And did she also give thanks to her ancestors and our ancestors?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the ancestors.
I declined. I declined.
I was just kind of just like, you know, taken aback. I'm like, so we're praising murderous ancestors now. That's what we're doing. That's a part of the healing process. I'm still learning.
White guests only. White guests only. And that's the way that she talks in her TED talk. That was in response to the question about what made you uncomfortable about the broadcast. She just wanted to get in her closing shtick, and I want to thank the ancestors and her new agey kind of Seattle rhetoric type of a thing. Like, what in the world? That's not even the question. And I suspect that for many victims, that would be enough. Like for a lot, even myself, when I was confused, like I didn't pay attention to that. Asking a white person a question and they don't really answer your question. They just get off into some rhetoric, and I just want to thank the ancestors. Oh, yes, that's right on. Thank the answer. And none of it's like, wait a minute. I asked the question. Did you? Wait a minute. And then you don't even catch that. See, they are so good with that type of a thing. And she did that a lot during the program. But I mean, at best, that's just like racist folly. Like at best, I mean, we can even go back to that question about sincerity, like, because I think that was another one where I asked about white people being sincerely and greatly pained about racism, and she said, well, I can't speak for all white people. Like that is like, that's happened so many times on the program where it's cliche, that'll be a way of weaseling out of a question, and I'm deliberately using that metaphor. I can weasel out of your question and get you on the defensive. Oh, I'm so sorry for that. Nobody even said that. This is just your view. You're not speaking for all the millions of white people on the planet. Just your analysis. Lame at its best. White supremacy, racism. Really, that right there. Language, that is the main weapon in being deceptive, not answering your questions, and confusing non-white people, and just out and out lying frequently. One of the big, I think June Bluespruce, she said that white people most confused about racism, white supremacy.
Towards the end, it felt like she was trying to do like a kumbaya moment. And for more confused victims, I suspect something like that would have made victims feel good and feel like that this is a nice, kind white woman. That's the vibes I got when she was doing her little spill towards the end.
I agree, like 1,000%. And especially if she had been like younger, these were older white women. If she had been younger, blonde, attractive, oh man. Total rap. And like I have seen this, like total rap. You can't even get it. Like, wait a minute. She didn't even answer our question. Shut up. This is a good, kindly white woman here. Like, I have totally been in the pro, like, lethally effective. Offer a tear or two. Game over.
I strongly suspect that both the white women on the line was practicing racism, white supremacy. I specifically asked
if either of them ever blame non-white people for their incorrect behavior without blaming the system of white supremacy. And they both have selective memory. I don't know. Earlier in the broadcast, I'm not sure which white woman was speaking, but they were saying when they were a little girl, they had said something incorrect about a black female at school, but they wouldn't say what it was. I also asked what was the motivating fear among white people that they were close to, and she wouldn't go into detail, but she would say how her parents and other relatives would say incorrect things about black people. So, yes, I find that to be a common tactic amongst the racist white supremacists and using selective memory.
Agreed. I think both of them, like, in not wanting to reveal too much, which is pretty standard, even I think that was June Blue Spruce when she was talking about the incident that she thought of as a child, where I'm sure any white person could probably think of times where they practiced racism, did something, said something like this month, this week, last hour, depending on, you know, what type of company they keep. But yeah, you wouldn't have to go back to your childhood years. But anyway, she said the incident where she said whatever in the bathroom. Oh, she said it was a black female. She said she said that she stunk. Or she didn't even say that at first. She just said she said something and had to, like, pry for a little bit of detail. She said, I said she stunk, and then her mom was outside the bathroom or whatever. Like, I feel like there were a number of points where they were, or just bad memories where I don't remember specific details about what was said or, you know, that type of a thing. Standard. Yeah, I think that's standard. I think even Miss Iverson, I think she said she was trying to think as well of times where someone had accused her of being racist. Or a number of points where, yeah, not the best memory. Which I think even the question we've asked about racist jokes, I think pretty much almost unanimously the white people have very bad memories, even if they've heard bunches, sometimes thousands, they said, of racist jokes. Can't remember one to share with us. Let's see. Much obliged, our male caller. Did any other folks comments, observations that they wanted to share? Grand, we'll be here tomorrow for Shaft Book Club. I am excited. Second session, very early in the book, but the book isn't that long. Written by a white man. Whew. I am excited. The homoeroticism abounds. My goodness. I'm excited. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Hope it was worthy of folks' time and energy. Always better to get refined, hone our skills, questioning individuals classified as white and studying them. Sobriety would be best. We would need well-functioning brain computers to solve our problem. In addition to being sober, if you're going to be out and about, be alert. Someone's being hostile and rowdy. Exit. You should be thinking that they may be armed. In fact, they may have an entire cadre of armed compadres with them, ready to kill and maim. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. If you're going to be out and about, you are sober. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone and buckled, just doing the small things to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.